It's my pleasure to introduce to you Frank Foti. Frank is CEO of Telos, of the Telos Alliance, and I can't read this thing. Here, it's better. The home of Telos Systems, Omnia Audio, Axia Audio, Linear Acoustics, and 25/7 Systems. He founded Omnia Audio, the innovative world-leading signal processing company. Say that fast five times. In 1988. Headquartered in Cleveland, Ohio, the Omnia line of audio processors are the benchmark of the broadcast industry. He leads a talented team that researches, designs, and develops audio processing for every form of broadcasting, FM, AM, HD radio, DAB, DRM, music mastering, and webcasting. He's a frequent presenter at NAB, AES, SBE, state broadcast conventions, and writes for all of the major broadcast industry trade publications. He's the recipient of the 2013 Engineering Achievement Award for Radio as presented by the NAB. In an earlier life, he got down and dirty in the trenches of day-to-day radio as chief engineer for a number of successful radio stations, WMMS and WHK in Cleveland, KSAN and KNEW in San Francisco, and the most well-known being Z100 WHTZ-FM in New York City, which he designed and built in 1983. Outside the world of broadcasting, he's deeply involved in the world of 1/8 inch live scale railroading. And Frank, I will like to add, Frank can talk to you about a number of subjects intelligently, but I think the one you would probably get the most enthusiastic response for is ask him about his trains. It's my pleasure to introduce no stranger to this group, Frank Foti.
Thanks, Gordon. First of all, it's always a pleasure to be invited up here to speak about various number of things. I have to say that today, and I apologize because I should have worn, I have a the better side of my life, got me this wonderful tie that's all these pictures of the 8th scale live steam engine. And so I think Gary's got a steam engine tie on and a few others, so it's us live steamers, you know, we stick together, you know. This past Sunday we had a run and, you know, I realize up here, I know I'm in Packer country, but and indulge me for a moment because it's been a long time since the Browns have been 3-2, you know, but in Cleveland they have this cheer that says, here we go Browns, here we go, you know, they do that, I'm not a dog, you know, woof woof. Well, I was running the steam engine this past Sunday, I'm going, here we go steamers, here we go, and I'd hit the horn and go, choo, choo, so that's how we'll kick it off. Also, like it's kind of fun because it was a wonderful way to get lassoed for this year. It was an honor to be in NAB and be in the green room with Leonard Charles and Jay Adrick. This is our reunion tour from the engineering achievement, and I couldn't think of two other great guys to have been honored as Jay and Leonard were. The third guy, you know, we'll save that for later. But in any case, I want to talk about something because for a number of years now, we've been doing a lot of work. I know I've talked to you guys about processing and surround sound and loudness and clarity and all this other kind of stuff. But one of the things that I've always dealt with or I think about is what is or could be looked at is the potential Achilles heel of a broadcasting system. And back, believe it or not, when we first brought out our first digital audio processor, which was introduced in 1997, I always wondered why couldn't we have the digital equivalent of the BNC connector that went from the stereo generator, in you know, an analog stereo generator, into the exciter. It for the life of me, I used to say to myself, why doesn't this exist? And as you'll see a little bit later on in the presentation, if I'm doing my little remote control gizmo correctly. Ah, there we go. it drove me crazy. And so today I'm going to talk about it because we've finally addressed it in a very cool way. And you're going to learn about how this city had something to do with this whole topic, believe it or not. So in any case, let's do a little bit of a history lesson. I know there's some of the young pups in the room, but for those of you guys, there was a time when in a transmission system, the system was set up like this. So yeah, where's the leisure suit? I'm glad no one's got one on. But in any case, there was a time when the audio processing was totally separate from what we would call the transmission side. And the transmission side included a stereo generator and an exciter. And this would be, I'd say, this is prior to the advent of the first Optima, the 8000. And while this worked and made sound on the radio, it suffered from a lot of problems. Most notably, because of pre-emphasis and the 15 kilohertz low-pass filter being in this area here, and this being analog, and this being nonlinear, any processing or clipping done over here would overshoot in these low-pass filters. As we know, and much to his credit, Bob Orban was the one who was able to come along and see if I get it right. Yes, when Bob introduced the Optimod 8000, Bob did two things. On the surface, it's like, if I'm pushing that. You may be thinking, well, he just put the stereo generator in with the audio processor. Yes, but the bigger part of the secret was that Bob was the first one to figure out how to get around the overshoot problem that the low-pass filters caused. And if any of you, just for the sake of wanting to delve deeper into having more knowledge, the whole secret to it is in understanding the nonlinear process and exactly where the overshoots occurred, and it's something called the Gibbs phenomenon. And believe it or not, the Gibbs phenomenon was first researched in the late 1800s in Cleveland, Ohio, at Case Western Reserve University. And Bob was the first one to figure out a way to manage or manipulate that such that the overshoots were suppressed. Then he was able to couple that tightly into the stereo generator. And then we have this wonderful, RJ58 cable that was going between the stereo generator and the exciter. And we made FM stereo, and we're able to modulate much more efficiently with next to no overshoots. And in this situation, electrically, what you're doing is you're coming into the exciter and you're being coupled directly into the modulator stage. So what's happening here, in theory, this here would give you a mirror image in modulation of the peak processing from the output of the audio processor. So I, again, as I said at the top, I always thought that, well, if we're going to do all of this in the digital domain, we should be able to do this in the digital domain, and we should be able to do this in the digital domain. Well, as you'll come to find, that didn't happen. And it, for the life of me, it made me crazy. And for some of you who may remember back in the late 90s, it turned into huge debates on BNET and all kinds of articles. And I have the jacket to prove it, I was even called a junk scientist to my face by another esteemed audio processing colleague, and I kept thinking, we're going to figure this out. Well, basically what happened was, with the advent of digital processors, was the processing and the limiting in the form of clipping and low-pass filtering was kept in the audio processor, and it was thought that a great way to go about it was, let's just use the standard AES EBU connection and go left-right into the stereo generator in the exciter. Well, what ended up happening was, in some cases, they were putting the pre-emphasis over here, and in order to use pre-emphasis here, you had to de-emphasize over here because the pre-emphasis was part of the processing, and if this de-emphasis network was not time-aligned to the pre-emphasis network that was over here, you'd have overshoots and all kinds of crazy things. So many of the exciter manufacturers gave you the ability to defeat the pre-emphasis circuit, which kind of, sort of made it work. And you put it on the air, and yes, it was in stereo. Yes, the peak control was kind of, sort of there, but it still wasn't the same as what we had in what I called the conventional analog domain. So my goal was, we're going to come up with a way to do it, excuse my language, come hell or high water. So while this was thought to be the cat's meow, and we were forced by the marketplace to do it, we stumbled across a number of problems with this system, and we're going to talk about them right now. And the problem was overshoots. The overshoots that were introduced, they were nowhere near as bad as the old leisure suit slide that I showed, but they were enough to say you're giving up 10% modulation due to overshoots, and we all know that 10% modulation is 1 dB in loudness. And I don't know of any program director or really engineer out there that's going to want to give up a dB in loudness. And while somebody might be saying, well, if Cliff here turns the volume down 1 dB, you're not going to hear much difference in level. And that's true, because my voice is not processed. But you take 1 dB of a highly processed signal and change it 1 dB and switch back and forth, you will hear the difference. Is it night and day? Some would say yes, some would say no. But I'll tell you, I don't know of a program director on the planet that isn't going to go, they sound a little louder because they have a dB that we don't. And I know if I was still in radio, I wouldn't want that PD, ringing me up every half hour wondering why, what happened to the sound of the radio station. So what happened? Why did we have overshoots? What was going on? Well, it all comes down to an issue known as sample rate conversion. We've all heard of it. We all accept it. We all use it. You probably don't realize that many of the things you plug in or disconnect or, inputs and outputs are using sample rate converters. And with non-processed audio, sample rate converters are fabulous. They're fantastic. They work wonderful. They do their job. No qualms. Until we get to the processed signal, sample rate converters become a problem. And here's why. This here is an overview of what I call the sample rate roller coaster. For the sake of our discussion, let's say we had a signal that's coming out of an audio processor at 32 kilohertz. This is what happens when you have an organization that deals in coding and processing and this and the other thing. Kilohertz sampling. And we need to get it, or I'm sorry, let's say, I or 32 kilohertz sampling, and we need to get it to a different sample rate. The way the sample, in this discussion here, we've got something coming into the audio processor at 32 kilohertz sampling. We do some sample rate conversion here, we do some audio processing here, limiting clipping, peak control is all nice and precise, and then what we end up needing to do is we want to get it from if this system here is, let's say, running at 48 kilohertz sampling, and we want to get it to a sampling rate at 32 kilohertz, because the output over here is at 48 kilohertz, we have to go through this block, the sample rate converter, to get it to be operating at the sampling rate that the exciter is operating at, and here's where our problem is going to come into effect, because the peak control at this point coming out of the audio processor is going to be precise. The problem is going to happen in this spot right here, and here's why. What I've done here is I've broken out that sample rate converter block into what is actually happening inside the block. All of this is done in software. What happens is we're coming in at 48 kilohertz on the sampling rate. We're going to upsample it by a factor of 10. The way that upsampling happens is we're going to take a sample, then we're going to insert 9 zeros, then another sample, 9 zeros, another sample, 9 zeros. So what we're going to end up with is 480 kilohertz sampling, but it's going to be dirty sampling because of inserting all those zeros. So in order to clean that up, we're going to insert a low-pass filter at this higher sampling rate, except that this low-pass filter is going to be set to the Nyquist frequency of the target sampling rate we want to get to. So in this case, if we want to convert from 48 to 32, this low-pass filter is going to be at 16 kilohertz. and it's going to be a very tight slope. I probably could have made this diagram a little tighter. And the reason for this low-pass filter is this cleans up those dirty samples. Now, what we have is we have a signal that is operating at a sampling rate of 480 kilohertz sampling, audio bandwidth of 16 kilohertz, and all we need to do is downsample it by a factor of 15 to get 32. And all we do to downsample it is we just take every 15th sample and we end up with 32 kilohertz sampling. The problem comes into play is this low-pass filter right here. Even though this low-pass filter is an FIR filter, which is theoretically phase linear, there will be some overshoot capability, because even though on a sine wave the response is going to be flat, a square wave response is going to be flat up until one-third the Nyquist frequency, and then the output as it changes to a sine wave is going to increase by a factor of 9%. So here's, 9%, 10%, there's that 1 dB in overshoot or lost loudness that's going to happen. It's going to happen right here. So what ends up happening is, yes, we have our targeted sampling rate, but we have overshoots. And a number of people used to ask me, they say, well, Frank, why do we even need this in the first place? Why didn't you make your audio processor operate at 32 kilohertz sampling? And the answer was, we know from our own development research, was that the early digital audio processors that used 32 kilohertz base sampling generated aliasing distortion in the processing itself. And if you're going to add other unwanted distortions to the signal processing itself, why even go digital in the first place? We knew that utilizing 48 kilohertz and some of, let's say, the black magic that we applied in the algorithm work to do our distortion-controlled final limiters, that everything worked much better utilizing 48 kilohertz as a base sampling rate. A lot of the magic, if you will, and the hard limiting is really not happening at those lower sampling rates. It's actually operating at a factor or two up from there. But still, back in the day when digital processing first came on the scene, to upsample something took more DSP. And we're talking about at a time when a single DSP chip, back in the early to mid 90s was $100 a pop. Well, today, those same DSP chips, they're $2 or $3 a pop. For what we were buying op amp, audio op amp chips for back then, we can get DSP for now. And the DSP chips of today are running 10 times or more the capacity of what we had, 15 years ago. So we made a design decision to use a higher sampling rate because it was sonically better as compared to 32 kilohertz. Which a number of people had adopted, and the exciter manufacturers had adopted it as well at that time. So this is the whole reason that the whole overshoot situation happened in the first place. And even I will tell you that signal processors that did use 32 kilohertz as a base sampling rate, for as much as they said there were no overshoots on the output, yes, there were, because we had them all, we measured them all, and every one of them led to one problem or another. So this is how we finally came to the answer, and it all happened right here in Madison, Wisconsin, 1 year ago, right now. I had one of the things about this little gathering is it's a good gathering among engineers, developers, vendors, and we all kind of rub elbows with one another, sometimes as friends. And a year ago, I think it's like a couple miles from here, is this little Italian restaurant called Vin Santo. And I happened to have dinner with Chuck Kelly and his crew from Nautel. And they said to me, Frank, we're doing some things with our newer lines of transmitters where we can accept a sampling rate of 192 kilohertz. Might there be anything we could do where you could give us the composite signal like that? And I said, Chuck, just so happens that I've done development work in my office with some high-speed D-to-A cars that run at 192 kilohertz, and they work just fine, spitting out the composite signal. As a matter of fact, I believe the stuff in the Omni 11 is based at 192. No reason why not. And, you know, in this current generation of electronics for broadcasting, and in probably most of the laptops that are sitting in this room right now, they all have converter chipsets inside of them that will do 192 kilohertz sampling. So the cost of being able to do stuff at a much higher speed has come way down. So we were thinking to ourselves, well, why can't we just use the AES transom? Just take the signal, plug it into the AES transom, and make it happen. So basically, it started, you know, we made the decision to do this and figured, you know, a little head scratching on our side, a little head scratching up in Canada. Maybe we can go to Las Vegas, which we did this past April, and show the world that we can do this. I want to reflect back a little bit, because this concept, like I told you at the beginning, this is something I thought about from the get-go. I mean, when we were first doing our development on what became Omni FM, the whole idea was, yeah, we were going to have a digital stereo generator, but we also wanted to have a way to go into the exciter, because we knew digital exciters were coming, and we wanted to keep everything digitally in the audio processor, and figured if we could digitally couple to the modulator, that would be a weapon on the air. I mean, and a weapon by knowing that the exciter would be able to mirror what the audio processor is doing. And if you could do that, there's going to be something to be gained sonically, and probably even a bit more modulation efficiency. So a year later, we went out and we bought, you know, one of the digital exciters at the time. And we've got some crafty guys at our place. And we all, you know, got the set of schematics. You know, we've never been one to call up another company and ask them how it works. We figure it out ourselves. Matter of fact, I think Mary Ann was in here, and she remembered that she used to do, many years ago, she worked for a company that were selling layer 2 codecs. And Steve Church, I'm diverting for a moment, and we made a business decision that said, if we want the Zephyr to become commonplace in our industry, we need to learn how to make it talk to a layer 2 codec. And one night we were sitting around, Steve and I, and we're saying, well, you think if we call up the people at, what the heck was the name of it? Yes, you know, do you think they'll tell us? No, we went out and bought one, and we had a couple guys, you know, friends of ours come in from Germany, and they reverse engineered it. And next thing you knew, we were, you know, able to communicate with a layer 2 codec. So what we did was we took an exciter. We figured out how the scheme would be to get the composite in to it. And we took it to NAB in 1998, and it worked. It worked great. Now, the difference was it was a one-off proprietary way of going about it. I think it had like 5 cables, because there were clock signals and sync signals and data and this, that, or the other thing that had to go back and forth to make it work. But we did prove that the concept would work. And the thing we noticed, because we had a little AB switch where you could switch back and forth between listening to the digital composite or the AES signal or even the analog composite, was that the digital composite there was a texture to it where the low end sounded a little tighter and the high end sounded a bit smoother. And everyone that we, you know, AB'd it for that week out in Vegas and even in our office, they all agreed. But we ended up realizing that the idea was a bit ahead of its time, basically due to the fact that there was no interoperability between what we were doing, other processing companies were doing, or the different RF guys were doing in the form of exciters. So I just kind of, you know, took that idea, stuck it on the shelf for a bit, and figured one day, you know, we will, you know, figure it out. So fast forwarding to last fall, you know, the picture of the little Italian restaurant. And by the way, if you guys do want to go to a nice restaurant, I mean, for good Italian food, that Vinsanto is very good. No, they didn't pay me to say that, but it's, you know, some of the locals here may know of it, but I highly recommend it. But we got to thinking about it. We figured, you know what? At first we said, you know, this would be something pretty cool. Let's, you know, this would be a feather in the hat for our friends at Nautel. It would be the ability to realize something I always wanted to see happen, and would also show that we're yet again trying to push the envelope to try to strengthen, you know, the transmission system. And we figured we'll go to let's go to Las Vegas. Let's show the tech and let's take the temperature. Well, I have to tell you that we did a joint press conference the Monday morning when the show started, and within 1 hour, Chuck Kelly tells me that the other processing guys were scurrying over there going, how can we do this? And within that same hour, all the other transmitter guys were over at our place going, Frank, how can we do this? And at first we thought, let's just work through the week in Nevada and we'll put our heads together. Peter, the CEO of Nautel, Chuck and myself, and we'll reevaluate everything. And it went over with such enthusiasm. I mean, I think I told the story about, you know, 100 or so times that week, that we made a business decision that I'm very, very proud of. And also, even I have a lot of respect for the Nautel group, but I raised even more with what I'm about to tell you. If, you know, parts of us were saying, we thought of it first, so let the other guys eat crow. But you know what? Where does it get you in business today? You know, VHS, beta, you know, iPhone, Android. It gets you nowhere. And in our industry, where we're fighting tooth and nail to be heard as an industry, we said, you know what? These other guys want it. Let them have it. There, you know, we basically, I told the other transmitter guys, I'll get you the info. And Chuck told the other processing guys, I'll get you the info. And basically, we're really just taking the composite, sticking it on the AES data stream, which is a standard. There's nothing about what I'm talking about needs to be approved. Doesn't need to go through NRSC, doesn't need to go through AES. You know, I mean, we don't even need to come to bat with chemical weapons about how to go about doing it. It works. So we made a decision there in Nevada when the show ended to make it available to anyone who wants to do it. And I do know that, you know, the other transmitter guys and other audio processing guys have adopted it, and it is a plug-and-play technology. So I think everything we've got on here, okay, if I push the right button, we'll get it. So let's talk about a little bit some of the advantages. Obviously, number one, we've accomplished this. It's analogous to it's the digital form of the BNC cable. There are zero overshoots. I mean, it you know, whatever the output of the audio processor is printing is what's going to go on the radio. I mean, unless there's something else further downstream that's going to cause some anomaly in an unwanted way to the sound or the transmission itself, it's beyond what we're doing. We have coupled the output of the stereo generator to the modulator in the best way possible. This part, I think, is very good because I do know that most of the exciters put these onboard, limiters or clippers, and they were put there, why? Not to be more audio processing, but that was the Band-Aid to get rid of the overshoots that I talked about earlier. And some of those limiters were pretty rough sounding. So there's no need for any of that. And also, you know, here in the United States, it does give us the ability to bring more of everything into one situation. Some of this is basically reiterating some of the things that I did talk about. It does support the ability to utilize the single sideband suppressed carrier technology, which is what I talked about here last year. And this point here is something that right now might not apply too much here in the U.S., but internationally will have a big impact. There's a lot of international broadcasters that have these, what they call networks, and it's really a format that might be, you know, the one that comes to my mind is France. They have a number of these, what they call big network radio stations, Skyrock, Energy, Fun, and they're based in Paris, And they're now getting in Europe, believe it or not, the ability to have some nice-sized, nationally driven data pipes. So if that data pipe is capable of handling this type of throughput, they could actually have one signal processor set in the main TOC area, and they could distribute composite throughout all over the country or wherever they need it to be. This, guys, is what happens when you do it on a Mac and then we transpose it onto Windows machines. But when I say it can be implemented, to my knowledge, the other digital exciter guys or transmission companies are in the process of implementing it. And I do know that, we've got things being tested with them as we speak. I do know that, the Nautel devices, not only do they have it, but it's this has been on the air for months already. And I have to laugh because to show you that the popularity of this topic, I've even seen where, a few other organizations are trying to lay claim to being the world's first. Well, if they didn't devise it, how can they be the world's first when us and Autel did it first? And obviously we had to go to radio stations and test the thing out. But again, we're not in it for ego. We're in it to make our industry better. And if any of you were here last year, and I see a lot of friendly faces that I recognize from last year, one of the premises that I said about this topic, and it applies to the topic we're talking about, is one of my goals is to when I say we, I'm talking about our organization, what can we do to help improve our industry? And there are times that, we can go out and do things to improve our industry, and the almighty buck is not the driving factor. The driving factor is to make something better or to do it because I think not only does it make it better, but it's cool. To be able to see this, one cable going from the audio processor into the transmitter, boom, done, on the air, working. And then we'll talk a little bit here in a moment. Probably the one thing you're probably saying, well, Frank, if you've done it, what does it sound like? Well, the advantages that I told you guys about back in the what we did in 1998 have printed through to today. The comments back to us have been the high end sounds smoother. And by the way, I probably need to go and dig into why this is, but I'm told that the high end sounds smoother. The low end does sound firmer. And when I say firmer, there's some low end feel to the sound that isn't there when we're running it in analog. And I don't know if that's because whatever's there numerically at the output of the stereo generator is going right to the modulator. And, there's probably some level of degradation that happens in the fact that there's, when we still have the analog connection, we have there's a set of converters there. There's a D to A that gets it down to the, back to pure analog. And then there's got to be a high speed A to D in the exciter. So being able to remove one more set of converters, there is some benefit to that. So as I get ready to wrap up here, now what you see is we've got basically, if you so choose to have, an all-digital path all the way through. Digital in whatever format or sampling rate you wish to have, because, as I mentioned, unprocessed audio through a sample rate converter, no problems there whatsoever. You're going to get a mirror image sonically at the output of the sample rate converter as you have coming in. And now, the connection here is basically done with, it's your common AES XLR cable. This past summer, I did a couple of webinars with the Nautel gang, and somebody said, Frank, shouldn't this be a cable with, 110-ohm terminators? Technically, yes. And I would imagine if this is going to be a long cable, you want to do that. But something short, like if this is in the rack and this guy's right below it, even if you just took like a mic cable and just, short mic cable, plugged it in, it does work. So, you know, digital exciter. So now what we're doing is we're coming right in and we're electrically going right to that modulator. So whatever this guy's doing, this guy's going to modulate. He's going to deviate it. And then from, you know, this point on, it's all basically, you know, up conversion and get it to RF, up the antenna, and out over the air. So here's yet again, let's say, our latest adventure into doing something that we feel would be for the betterment of FM broadcasting. You know, I believe there'll be a unit here that'll have it running. I think when the exhibits open up, if you have any other questions about it, unfortunately, when I'm done, I have to make my way back to Cleveland, and I see that we have here some time for some questions. But beyond that, you know, there's a white paper about this on our website, and yes, we still play with trains, so, you know, I'm happy to entertain any questions from any of you guys at this time. And again, I want to thank Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and the Broadcasters Clinic for having this opportunity. It's, you know, it's one of the venues I always look forward to being a part of. Thank you very much. That sounds like a train right there. You got it. No, okay. Any questions? If not, I guess we'll move on.
How will this play with the live wire systems, and what would be the best way to implement it, using an AES node or an audio node into it? Any suggestions?
Well, in the world of live wire, you know, you can go into the Omnia or any of the Omnia processors with live wire, be your audio in. The output, as of this moment, is a special AES signal, and the signal is sampled at 192 kilohertz. LiveWire is not capable of handling a sampling rate. LiveWire is not capable of handling a sampling rate that high. So basically, you'd have two different connections. You'd have LiveWire if you wanted it to go into the audio processor, but then you've got a separate connection between the audio processor and the exciter. Silence falls over the room. Oh, Mr. Bain, this gentleman here, I think, is part of the Chicago Mafia.
Thanks Greg. Besides the 11, and if you have an 11 that came out before this was implemented, you can retrofit it.
Yes.
What other stereo generators will be able to be upgraded?
Within our product line, the Omnia 9 will do this. The Omnia 11, which can be upgraded. And we've got some things that are, let's say, in the thinking cap stage going forward. I have been asked, can we do this with the older Omnias? Unfortunately, the answer is no. Reason being is we've maxed out, you know, all the instructions that are, or the instruction set in like an Omnia 6 or an Omnia 3 or an Omnia FM.
And Omnia 1, maybe not?
That one we're still kicking around
okay.
with.
Thanks, Frank.
You're welcome. On that note, gentlemen, you guys have a wonderful day and enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.